Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic on the 101 southbound in the East Valley. A crash at Southern has the right lane blocked. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, but a high of only 61 degrees. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the upper 30s. Sunny and 61 again for tomorrow, up to 63 on Thursday. Same for Friday with a slight chance of rain. Right now in Phoenix, few clouds overhead, 57 degrees at KJZZ. Lucid Motors has announced the company will be opening its newest electric car manufacturing site in Casa Grande. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, the deal is expected to bring about 2,000 jobs to the area by 2022.
Company officials said several factors attracted them to Arizona, including access to interstates and land that could quickly be ready for plant construction. Proximity to their supply chain in Mexico was also a factor. Sonora Governor Claudia Pavlovich attended Tuesday's announcement. She said the economic teams of Sonora and Arizona have been working together for several months to make this project a reality.
This announcement proves, without a doubt, how bilateral relations can bring prosperity for our citizens when we work for common goals.
Plant construction and initial hiring are expected to start in 2017, with the start of production following shortly after in 2018. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This morning, a somber ceremony marked the opening of the Granite Mountain Hotshots Memorial State Park near Yarnell.
Andrew Ashcraft. Christopher McKenzie. Dustin DeFord.
The new 320-acre state park honors the 19 firefighters who died 3 years ago fighting a wildfire on the site. Governor Doug Ducey spoke to the crowd at the memorial this morning and said he hopes the opening of the memorial will help in the healing process.
These were young men who committed their lives and careers to public service and public safety. But they were also husbands, sons, brothers, and fathers. This park will be a place to reflect, to mourn, and to learn.
This is the first Memorial State Park in the state, and the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with Sue Black, Arizona State Park's executive director, about this, and Lauren joins me. So, Lauren, the families of the 19 hotshots had a part in planning this memorial, is that right?
That's right. They wanted the memorial to be part of the land and not to be too built up. So it's actually a 7-mile round-trip hike that you can take that leads to the site where the hotshots were killed. And when I reached Sue Black on her cell phone up in northern Arizona where she was near the memorial site, she told me it's really something you experience, and doing it helps you understand what these 19 men went through before they died.
I hiked it on Friday for one last time before the dedication ceremony, and I will tell you, it really is a journey. The first part of the trail, we call that the Hotshot Trail. That's about 2.5 miles in. And about every tenth of a mile, 600 feet, is a memorial plaque to each of the different hotshots. And that was by design so that you could experience each of the different guys kind of independently, if you will. And as you get to the top of the trail and you've read everyone's story and you've had time to reflect, you become kind of immersed in it. And then you're at this top part where there's this overlook, and then you look down to the site where the tragedy actually happened. And we call that Journey Trail because it was their final journey. And as you go down, and then you get down to where the Gabions and where the actual circle is, it's a real tribute to them. And I hope it's meaningful for everyone and for national and international visitors and for decades to come. It's something that was a true labor of love, and I hope that we did justice for the guys.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's a really intimate experience, these markers and photos throughout. There are messages from the family members of the hotshots as well. What is that like to experience?
Well, it's emotional, and the families actually wrote the words on each of the different plaques. So it came right straight from them, and they picked the picture and what have you. And with the difficulty of the trail, because it's not an easy hike, you realize what these guys had to go through, fighting a fire with, you know, 60 or 80 pounds on their backs, and you realize just what grueling work that they really did on all of our behalf. It's humbling.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the end of the trail. You said there's a sort of a 3/4 mile journey trail that goes to the spot where they died. And I wonder, what went into that decision to kind of protect that spot? It says it's protected by a circle of baskets.
One of the designs is to have these 19 gabions connected by chains that would circle the actual markers or crosses that are on the site. And those actually don't have individual names on it because we wanted to show that they were a true team and the connectedness that encircled where the crosses are. To me, that's very reverent, sacred ground. And I really don't want anybody to go in there because I think that you can look from the outside and respect that.
So the decision to sort of preserve that spot where they died, how do you balance that when you're designing this? How do you honor their passing and their family's mourning, but still sort of open it up and make it a public experience for people to go to?
You know, when it first happened, the markers or the crosses went up immediately. And when we were looking at the design, it was like, don't touch that, but let's somehow protect it. And the gabions even protect it from erosion. And it's a strong statement when you see how they're all, you know, tied together as one team.
That was Sue Black, Executive Director of the Arizona State Parks. The Granite Mountain Hotshot Memorial State Park will be open to the public for the first time tomorrow.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
An uproar over spiking water bills has led to an effort to recall the mayor of Buckeye. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports on an ongoing issue in one of the fastest-growing cities in the country.
Buckeye resident Chad Taylor had to work on Thanksgiving, so he and his daughter put up Christmas lights early.
Thank you, sweetie.
Taylor moved his family to the Southwest Valley at the height of the recession, and he got a great deal on a home. The water bills averaged less than $200 a month, until recently. Then Taylor says his bill more than tripled to $800.
That's the equivalent of me dumping my pool in my yard 3 times and filling it up.
Taylor called the city and was told the meter showed he used the water. Buckeye raised residential water rates this year, but not that much. Maybe he had a leak? Taylor had his plumbing and landscaping checked. Nothing came up. When Taylor aired his frustration publicly, he found out he wasn't the only person with concerns.
Many residents right now feel that the city, there's something criminal going on, and that the city is actually stealing the money.
Taylor admits there's no evidence to support such a theory. Still, he's helping lead a petition to recall Mayor Jackie Meck. Meck declined to answer questions about the recall. He instead read a statement about the city's efforts to work with people whose water bills have spiked. Meck says there have been growing pains, but he's working hard to get to the bottom of it.
I respect their right to recall, but I would rather work with individuals face-to-face to solve problems and make our city great.
Meck, who won re-election this year, has been involved in local government for decades. He's watched Buckeye transition from a farming community to a suburb. Fields still surround clusters of homes, but all combined, the city covers hundreds of square miles. Dan Jackson, a consultant hired by the city, has spent years analyzing Buckeye's water system. He says it's the largest service territory in Arizona, and that presents a unique challenge.
When you're trying to run a water utility, you have to provide water service throughout the entire city. It's very spread apart, and that really increases the cost.
Another issue is that Buckeye does not have access to outside sources of water. This means it's entirely dependent on what it can extract from the ground. The city has about 30 wells that pump water into treatment facilities. Jackson says purification is an expensive process.
That water's got arsenic in it. It's got other minerals in it that have to be taken out before it can be sent to its ultimate ratepayer, and all that comes at a great cost.
But none of these factors explain why some Buckeye residents' water bills have soared. The city hired a PR firm to educate people on water rates and conservation efforts, and a hotline was set up for concerned customers. Officials say more than 100 people called, and about 50 cases have been resolved. City Water Resources Director Dave Nye says leaks weren't the only cause of huge bills.
Oh, there's been a few things. There's been a few misreads and some human error involved with data entry, but that's been 99.9% of it.
The city has also picked a company that will check the entire system. But officials could not say when work will begin.
They're going to review everything from start to finish to make sure we're following best management practices and we don't have any errors out there.
For Taylor, one of the residents pushing to oust the mayor, that's not enough.
The trust is gone. You know, the trust at this point's just been broken.
August is the earliest a recall election could take place. That gives city officials months to come up with answers. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Buckeye.
Last year, state lawmakers and Governor Doug Ducey zeroed out state funding for the Maricopa Community College District. Officials say the district has lost about $400 million since 2008. And by way of full disclosure, KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. Last night, the district's governing board and chancellor held a special meeting in Glendale to lay out plans for a restructuring of the 10 colleges. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn was there and joins me now. So, Casey, the district has written up a resolution outlining this new transition. What does it say?
Sure. So the resolution basically gives some details on what changes the chancellor wants to make to the community colleges. Now, there weren't a lot of specific details written in it, which is one reason why they held the meeting last night. Essentially, it talks about where the district is today, and the key paragraph is the last one. That says the chancellor will need to exercise appropriate options like reductions in force. Here's Chancellor Maria Harper-Marinick speaking at the meeting to give a little more detail on the plans.
We are talking about a reorganization of the upper levels of administration, specifically leadership roles, to create a regional approach to how we serve the community.
Harper-Marinick says that might look like grouping community colleges together by where they are and having only one president for both.
Now, Casey, this resolution is still just a proposal, meaning it can be changed. What did the public have to say about it, and did people offer any suggestions?
Well, it was a packed house with something like 200 people there, college employees and community members both. At first, the tone of the public comment seemed like an attitude of working together, which is what representatives from faculty and different community colleges said. There weren't too many people who spoke, but finally around the last minute, after the governing board had talked again, a few faculty members seemed to muster up some courage and speak about what was on a lot of people's minds there. College employee Christina Bolliard said she wasn't planning on talking, but had to ask the board what the resolution meant for her department.
What does this mean, redeployment of staff? What does this mean, voluntary separation? We know what the words defined mean. But what does that mean to us, and what does that mean to the service that we provide to students?
And that same worry was echoed by a lot of other people who spoke as well, and some people I spoke to after the meeting.
So what's next for this resolution then?
Well, like you said, it is still just a proposal, and the board members said they expect a lot of amendments to come before the final draft is approved. And when it does get approved in the coming months, there's still the details that need to be crafted to get the plan moving, and those are still to be determined. This is basically just the first step in a big change, and there is another special meeting next Monday, December 5th, at the Mesa Convention Center.
That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5, along with Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. I'm Mark Brody. Let's talk about the country's infrastructure.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals.
But you look at our tunnels, they're disgusting, they're dirty, there's soot, the tiles are all off, the roads are in bad shape. You know, as a builder, it's disgusting to me. You go through these tunnels, I like tippy-top. I like everybody goes to my buildings and my clubs, they're tippy-top.
The American Infrastructure Act leverages public-private partnerships and private investments through tax incentives to spur $1 trillion in infrastructure investment over the next 10 years.
When we fix the infrastructure of our country, I want that to be under budget.
If our bridges and tunnels were beautiful and new and fresh.
So fresh and new, Donald Trump says he's got $1 trillion in store for tunnels and bridges and roads and water. It's the kind of talk that makes Democrats absolutely salivate. They've been gunning for big spending on infrastructure for years, and it was even a silver lining for a lot of Dems after Mr. Trump's victory in the presidential election. Well, today, Donald Trump announced former Labor Secretary Elaine Chao as his choice to be Transportation Secretary. She served under President George W. Bush. Now, Chao also served as Deputy Secretary of Transportation under President George H.W. Bush. And if you're wondering how hard a time Chao might have getting confirmed by this GOP Senate, Elaine Chao happens to be married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Well, if she is confirmed by the Senate, she'll be in a key position to implement Trump's infrastructure plan. Now, Dems have been cautiously approaching the president-elect's outstretched hand ever since Election Day, wondering if there might be some billions for public works in there. But one top Democrat advisor says this is not FDR, and Trump's infrastructure plan is not what Democrats have been dreaming of. Everyone who watched the populist rise of blue-collar voters wants to find a way to deliver and put those people to work. But Ronald Klain is loudly telling Democrats, don't fall for it, no matter how tippy-top. Klain was an assistant to President Obama. He helped oversee the 2009 stimulus, and he was an advisor to Hillary Clinton's campaign as well.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if there is hope for a common agreement here. I mean, why do both Democrats and Donald Trump want a giant infrastructure project, plan, whatever form it takes, so badly? I mean, of course, infrastructure is in need of repair. Everyone has a stake in all 50 states. But what we're talking about here is the potential for employment for millions of underemployed blue-collar workers without a college degree, right? And the opportunity to fill a big hole at the nexus of our economy and our politics that really helped drive this last election in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania.
Well, look, I don't know what Donald Trump wants. What I know is what he's proposed, which isn't really an infrastructure plan. It's a tax cut plan for wealthy investors. I know that Democrats believe firmly that we need a big infrastructure program like the one Secretary Clinton put forward in the 2016 campaign for both the reasons you talk about, Todd. On the one hand, we do have crumbling infrastructure in a lot of areas and certainly need to maintain and improve our infrastructure to keep our competitiveness as a country. How much time it takes, how complicated it is to move goods to market, to move people to their jobs. All these things have a big economic impact, and great infrastructure makes our country more efficient and more successful. And then, of course, there are jobs created when you go to build these things. I think we need to be careful not to overclaim how many jobs are created. A lot of infrastructure projects now use a lot of machinery. They are very sophisticated in how they schedule workers. They may not create as many jobs as in the past, but they do create jobs. They are generally good-paying jobs, and they're jobs, as I said, that adds to our overall productivity and success as a country. So if we had a real infrastructure plan on the table that really addressed our national needs, I think that would be something that Democrats would support, something we've proposed time and again, something that we put in the Recovery Act in 2009 when President Obama was trying to get us out of the recession, and something he proposed additional versions of throughout his presidency. So it's definitely a need, but it's got to be done the right way. If it's done the wrong way, you wind up not really solving our needs, spending a lot of taxpayer money, making some big construction industry investors quite rich, but not really creating jobs and not really fixing our problems.
So despite the losses in this election, Ronald Klain, Democrats do have some power here. What you're doing is appealing to the 48 or so Democratic senators who have the filibuster power here on any big infrastructure plan that comes their way. What have you been telling them about what they should try to win as concessions in this negotiation that Paul Ryan would agree to over on the other side of the Capitol and that ultimately Donald Trump might sign?
So I think Democrats, you know, we are a minority in the House and Senate, but a majority in the country. And we are the opposition, but not really the minority party. And so I think they need to focus less on what Paul Ryan will agree to, what Donald Trump will sign, and more on what they stand for. What are our core beliefs as a party? What are we fighting for? What are we standing up for and speaking out for? And I think here the answer should be clear. We should be speaking out for really addressing the national needs of water systems like the ones in Flint, Michigan, but all around the country that need upgrades, roads that really need to be first class, bridges that are in repair. We need to be speaking up to those needs, doing that in a way that creates real jobs for working people and that doesn't undercut our labor and environmental protections. I think if we stand up and speak out and fight for those things, we'll have the country behind us, and the Republicans will have to go along. I think the most important thing for Democrats is to remain true to our principles and to really fight for real change that will really help people.
Ronald Acklin is busy trying to rally Democratic troops to stand and fight when it comes to infrastructure and a plan that Donald Trump may put forward to Congress once he takes the oath of office. Ronald Acklin was an assistant to President Obama and also an advisor to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
And that was The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. Arizona's physician shortage has been well documented, and a coalition of healthcare groups and universities is trying to reduce it. Dignity Health St. Joseph's Hospital and Medical Center, Maricopa Integrated Health System, District Medical Group, and Creighton University are working together to train more docs here with the hope they'll stay here to practice. Dale Davenport is Senior Associate Dean for the School of Medicine at Creighton University. And Dale, how big of a dent do you think this program could put into the state's doctor shortage?
Well, just as an example, we will have, with Maricopa Integrated Health System and Dignity Health, those two health systems together have about 450 physician-trained physicians. We know through experience nationally that physicians are more likely to reside in the area where they have completed their training, so that more physicians who are trained in Arizona will likely stay in Arizona. That's the model that we're using.
Do you think the overall size that all these groups combined makes up, does that help you in any way? Is there a certain economy of scale here that helps you train more physicians and get more doctors into the workforce here?
Absolutely. As you follow healthcare today, everything is sort of about scale. For a variety of reasons, having a larger network of hospitals and patients, there's some really specific advantages. It allows us, from the education standpoint, to expose students to a much broader diversity of patients as well as types of illnesses. You need a very large base of patients in order to train many of our subspecialists. It's just a function of how many patients are in the network that would need some of the more specialized services. So that is by far the distinct advantage, but also it will give opportunities for some programs that one of the health systems has that the other one does not. So for instance, St. Joseph Hospital today has an excellent family medicine residency program. Our partners at Maricopa do not have that program, but they're very interested in expanding primary care throughout Maricopa County. So they are interested in adding training positions in family medicine.
How do you see this program being different from others around the state and around the valley that are basically trying to do the same thing, for example, at the U of A Med School, which recently opened in Phoenix as a way to, as you said, get more residents here with the hope that they will then stay here?
Yeah, actually, in that manner, I don't see a difference. I think it's very similar. I want to stress that the relationship we've established with Maricopa, with the district medical group, and with St. Joseph's is not an exclusive arrangement. In other words, the training that they're doing for other institutions will continue. We see this as a way to expand and to try to address the unmet needs.
Dale Davenport is Senior Associate Dean at the Creighton University School of Medicine. Dale, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark, for the opportunity to participate in the call.
Table tennis has long been regarded as a good way of enhancing brain power, so much so it's sometimes offered as therapy for people with Alzheimer's disease. In the UK, a charity is looking to fund the delivery of specially designed tables for retirement homes and to involve young players as well as the elderly. The BBC's Rob Bonnet reports from one such home in London.
Well, they're knocking up at Birchwood Grange Care Home in northwest London in preparation for delivery of the Bat Foundation's Mark II tennis table.
Roger, you've played this game before.
My youth club days.
Okay.
100 years ago.
Not quite that many. Were you a good player?
Fair to middling.
Yeah.
And here's another resident, Annie.
A lot of fun. You can have a laugh with it, you can do it seriously.
Yes. Are you competitive?
No.
Aren't you?
I'm a softie. If it's somebody older than I am or a child, I'll let them win. Oh. I do, because I haven't got the heart to see the little face go, oh dear.
Hello, I'm Ian Creighton Chambers. I'm a founding trustee of the Bounce Alzheimer's Therapy Foundation and its creative director. In Japan, two neuroscientists did a very big clinical study, and they were so amazed by the results that they called table tennis the world's number one brain sport. And a neuroscientist writing for the New York Times called table tennis chess on steroids, which I thought was quite charming.
Which is why Alzheimer's patients benefit in particular from the therapy that comes with the game, boosted by a specially designed table with elevated opaque side panels to keep the ball in play, and an orange ball played against a white background to reduce the visual impairment that can accompany the disease. All this has the support of Table Tennis England and Head of Development Emily St. John.
I think it's really, really exciting that this new type of table potentially gets new audiences playing. We're seeing it being used and tried with young people as well as older people who, you know, are really enjoying having longer rallies and playing the game in a slightly different form. So incredibly exciting from our perspective.
Yes, research in America has demonstrated that the impact of the genetic inheritance of dementia can be limited by learning the game at a young age. And so the development program continues across the age range.
We are already developing a Mark III. I would quite like to put some motion sensors in it so that we can record voices, so when the ball passes over, good shot, well done. This is all new stuff. I mean, no one's done this before. And so it's exploring possibilities. It's a sort of fusion of design intervention with sports intervention.
Well, Annie may say she's not competitive, but Birchwood Grange manager Mark Bird sees an inter-care home league ahead.
We are very competitive, especially Birchwood Grange. You always want to be the best. Our residents love to win, so therefore it's no different to you and I and anyone else that actually enter a competition. It'd be fantastic.
And beyond that, who knows? Maybe a place for this modified game in the Paralympics.
Well, I think there's a great possibility. Now that we've had the Paralympics, I'm looking to talk to the table tennis players especially, get them involved in the process and input their expertise and experience.
Are you optimistic of success?
I'm very optimistic, yes.
That's Ian Creighton Chambers speaking there to the BBC's Rob Bonnet. The Arizona Department of Water Resources recently issued a reminder of sorts to farmers and community gardeners in the valley that they could be in violation of the Groundwater Management Act of 1980. That law is often credited with helping the state prepare for and deal with its current drought. Under the act, new irrigated farms in certain parts of the state cannot be bigger than 2 acres. For more on this, I'm joined by Tom Bouchotsky, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. And Tom, what prompted your agency to put this out?
So we occasionally see newspaper articles and such about the community gardens, these urban gardens going in various places, and we just wanted to have an attempt to help educate folks about what the potential restrictions are for those specific community gardens. And under the Groundwater Code of 1980, irrigation is defined as 2 acres of or more of growing anything for sale or human consumption. And so these things, if they are 2 acres or more in size, unless they have an exemption, would really be outside of what's allowed under the Groundwater Code.
Are there a lot of community gardens or urban farms in these active management areas that you think might be running afoul of the Groundwater Management Act?
I really don't think that it is a huge problem in terms of the volume or the number of acres in total. But again, I think it behooves us during this drought period that we get people to understand that there are some restrictions out there potentially. And I hate to do it after the fact, where they've already created and put the effort into creating one of these community gardens. I think, again, it's better to get it out in the open that there's these restrictions before they put all that effort into creating these things.
How do you go about finding if there is a garden or a farm that's in violation? I mean, do you have inspectors? Does ADWR have inspectors that go out looking for these sorts of things or checking them out if they get a tip?
So, I mean, we're not actively
driving around looking for these things. But again, if we become aware of one, then we would maybe look into it a little bit.
Has this been an issue in the past?
You know, I think this has cropped over the last couple of years. And if you look at climate change adaptation protocols, these community gardens are one of the methodologies that are touted as part of those protocols, i.e. growing your food more locally, reducing the carbon footprint of transporting the food, you know, having the green stuff in city landscapes. So I've been aware of that as a protocol under some of those functions for a good 12 or 13 years.
Yeah, this does kind of seem to pit two ideas against each other, which is the idea of water conservation and following established water law with the desire to grow your own food and have locally sourced produce, basically.
Yeah, I agree with you. It does pit different policies potentially against one another. But again, the ban on irrigation above 2 acres was a key component of the groundwater code, which was counting on existing agriculture going away through pretty much market forces and the resultant water savings that was going to create it. And that's why they had a pretty strict prohibition in that law against irrigating new acres, because then you wouldn't get that concomitant reduction in water use that you were looking for back when they put the groundwater code together in 1980.
Tom Bouchotsky is director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. To get a sense of what kind of impact this guidance might have on Valley farmers and gardeners, I headed out to a Phoenix farm.
My name is Greg Peterson. I live at a place called the Urban Farm, and the Urban Farm is a third of an acre in north central Phoenix, and I have converted this third of an acre into an edible landscape.
Peterson's front yard is lined with fruit trees. He says there are more than 80 of them on the property. Standing just a few steps from a bed where he's growing kale, chard, and other veggies, I asked him what he makes of the note from the State Water Resources Department.
Mostly the projects, in fact, pretty much completely the projects that I'm working on are small. So they fit nicely under that 2 acre piece. In fact, most of them are 10,000 square feet or less. So that's what, a quarter of an acre or so. So mostly it doesn't impact the work that I'm doing and the work that we're doing here. And I think a lot of the bigger farms are grandfathered in on their flood irrigation rights.
Well, given, as you say, that in your mind, a lot of the projects that you're working on and probably a lot of the projects other folks are working on are less than 2 acres, it sounds like maybe you don't think this is such a big deal.
I don't see it impacting the work that a lot of the urban farmers are doing here in the valley because it is under 2 acres.
Given some of the technology that is emerging and some of the practices that folks like yourself are trying to use now to conserve water, do you think it is as big of an issue now that folks are thinking about how they're using the water and maybe think about ways to try to use less of it to still grow the same kind of stuff they want to grow?
You know, I think the guideline itself kind of plants a seed for water conservation. Listen, we live in a desert. There's 4.4 some million people that live in the Phoenix metropolitan area. We have to either get the food here or we have to grow the food here because we have to feed people. So we either use the water here or use it somewhere else in the globe and ship it. So it's really a trade-off. And the guidelines, it's planting the seeds for us to really get conscious about the water we are using because we need to.
How closely do you pay attention to potential new technologies, new practices, new ways of maybe using water more efficiently or using water differently than how you have in the past?
Well, I like to stay up on that. There are so many things happening now. You know, we live in such a technology-rich research world. You know, I'm not on it every day, but, you know, I pay attention on a monthly basis, especially around the water issue, you know, because we're in the middle of a drought. We have to figure this out.
And have you found, you know, over the past X number of years that you have changed how you do things based on new information or new technology?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I wish I'd have known what I know now 20 years ago. I'd have been doing things a lot differently. Here's what I tell people. You do the best you can with the information that you have right now. And then you go out and learn some more. And when you learn, you get to do better.
Greg Peterson lives on the urban farm in north central Phoenix.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia. But you can get in on the action, too. Just solve this riddle. I'm tall when I'm young, and I'm short when I'm old. What am I? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, 101 southbound, a crash on the side of the road at Southern. That's the 101 southbound. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 61. Clear and chilly tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 30s. Sunny and 61 tomorrow, up to 63 on Thursday. It's 59 degrees right now at KJZZ at 244.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, presenting a flurry of festivities in December, including Breakfast with Santa and Snow Much Fun Day. Tickets and info at childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
This season has been a surprise for the Arizona Cardinals, but not really in any way a good surprise. Before the season, the Cards were a trendy pick to at least make the Super Bowl, if not win it. But after Sunday's loss to the Atlanta Falcons, the Cards stand at 4 wins, 6 losses, and a tie, 6 spots out of the playoffs if the season ended today. To find out what's going wrong, I'm joined by Jess Root, site editor for Cards Wire, which is part of USA Today's NFL Wire. And Jess, when you and I spoke before the season, you said it's basically Super Bowl or a big disappointment and heartbreak for the Cards this year. Seems like it's a lot more of the latter than the former.
It's definitely what has happened. They brought back really everybody on the offensive side of the ball. And on paper, they improved defensively. But things haven't gone this. So, yes, it has been a very, very disappointing season. Even I don't even know if it would be heartbreaking, because the heartbreak I would have referred to at the beginning of the season would be making the playoffs again and falling short. And at this point, it doesn't look like, I mean, it's a long shot for them to even make the postseason.
Was there anybody that you talked to or anybody associated with the team that thought this is how it would go this year?
Not at all. From local media to the team to national media, everyone expected a Super Bowl run. I mean, they were a popular pick to be in the Super Bowl, if not to win the Super Bowl. And everyone sort of, never saw a publication that saw them missing the playoffs this season.
So you mentioned that on paper, at least, the defense got better. They brought back a lot of their key players. So what happened between the paper and the field?
Well, a number of things. Kind of the big thing that has been is special teams. And that's the area where you didn't see a lot of changes. They have their same kicker, their same punter. Their kick return game hasn't been great. But you can point to really to a couple of things. Defensively, if you look at the stats, they're the number one defense in the league in yards allowed. They were number one in offensive points allowed. But now after, you know, it felt not real. And we saw that on Sunday when they gave up the 38 points to Atlanta. So they give up, they don't give up many yards, but they're giving up points. They're 10th in points allowed. It's just mistakes. It's kind of odd because they're getting to the passer. They're getting more sacks. And they played well in coverage, but they have untimely mistakes. There'll be a penalty where they shouldn't have it, that'll extend drive, or they'll give up a play on third down. So it's been just a lot of little things, defensively at least.
What kind of reaction has this season been getting inside the Cardinals locker room? How are the players, coaching staff, management, how are they all handling this?
At the start, it was sort of unbelief, disbelief. Now it's frustration. The players are bummed. They're disappointed. The coaches are kind of, they're They're disappointed because they practice really well. So that when they lead up to the games, they're well prepared. They're just making mistakes. Optimism is still there. There's no evidence right now that they've given up because mathematically they're still in the hunt. And as long as they make the postseason, then anything can happen. And that's kind of like, it's kind of where they were meant to be to begin with.
Have you gotten any indication that head coach Bruce Arians might be facing some job security questions?
Not at all. Definitely not after one season. That's been difficult. They had, I mean, look at the 3 years that they had. They won 10 games. They won 11 games. They won 13 games and were in the NFC Championship. They're allowed to have a bad year, and even still, they're not even out of it. And there's no evidence that he's lost the locker room at all. So obviously it's disappointing, and this would be a trend to watch in the year or two beyond this, because that's kind of how things happened with the last head coach, with Ken Whisenhunt. But no, his seat isn't getting hot at all, as they like to say. There's no hot seat even getting close. However, it hasn't been a good year for him, and it would be more than fair to criticize some of the decisions that he's made as a coach and as an evaluator.
Jess Root is NFL site editor for Cards Wire, part of USA Today's NFL Wire, talking about what is going on with the Arizona Cardinals. Jess, thank you as always.
All right, appreciate it.
This hour, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas unveiled a plan to improve public education in Arizona. The 162-page AZ Kids Can't Wait 2017 proposal calls for $680 million for increasing teacher salaries, rural schools, and school building maintenance, among other things. It would also restructure the state's accountability system and reduce the importance of statewide testing. Joining me to talk about this proposal is Rebecca Gao, Executive Director of Stanford Children Arizona. And Rebecca, let me ask you first, what are your initial thoughts about what Superintendent Douglas is proposing?
Our initial thoughts are, first of all, we really appreciate that she did go around the state listening to folks who've been involved in education for a while, and she really does seem to have taken a lot of the concerns that are out there to heart. And so that is always really good to see from your state education leader. So really appreciate that. And a lot of the elements in there, it's really hard to disagree with. It's really hard to disagree with anything that she has in there. It does kind of feel like an education Christmas list. There are really good elements, but not a lot of hard choices. For example, the funding that she talks about discusses the funding source of the rainy day fund and nothing else. And that is the crux of the matter when we're discussing about education funding, is where does the money come from? So we'll be coming out soon with some education funding concepts that we look forward to discussing and hope, really hope to have a dialogue with her about those sophisticated choices that have to be made in Arizona.
What do you make of her idea of reducing the importance of statewide testing? Arizona, of course, just started taking a new test, the AZ Merit Exam. Do you think that there is merit in the idea of reducing the importance of that test?
Well, I'm not sure that the importance of the test is what she's looking to reduce. And granted, I haven't had a lot of time to read the plan. It was just released. But in the pages that I saw, I understand her interest in reducing the overall test taking because of the testing that happens related to preparing for an assessment. So I can understand a desire to release the testing burden. The fact is, though, that actually a very low percentage of student time is spent taking tests in our state. I haven't seen, when you look at like the A through F letter grade system and the task force that's looking at how schools are graded on that scale, I'm not seeing any real desire across the state to reduce how assessments play in that. Those are two slightly different issues.
Rebecca Gao is Executive Director of Stanford Children Arizona. Rebecca, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
Fasting has been growing in popularity in recent years, but it turns out it's not just about weight loss. If you believe the hype, there could be all sorts of health benefits from preventing arthritis and curing Alzheimer's. But fasting, really? We had reporter Elena Gordon from WHYY's The Pulse dig into the science behind this growing trend. She started by spending some time with a faster who recorded an audio diary of her day without food.
Mimi Dexter L. has not had breakfast in over 2 years.
It is 7:06 in the morning. I am about to get ready for work.
Dexter L. lives in Phoenix and works in marketing.
And right now I am smelling the wonderful aromas of my dear mom making breakfast.
Dexter L. is a big proponent of what's called intermittent fasting. She's even got a blog and Facebook page.
I'm smelling onions, mushrooms, eggs, all this wonderful breakfast food, but I will not be having it.
There are several ways to do intermittent fasting. Some don't eat anything a couple days a week. Others eat every other day. And then some eat during a specific window. For Dexter L., that's between 5 and 10 p.m., which means at lunchtime...
Instead of heating my lunch in the office, I'm heating some tea. White tea, actually.
Dexter L. says she had tried a bunch of different diets and exercise approaches.
But, you know, usually would lose the weight, gain it all back, and then some.
Then, a couple years ago, she realized things were really getting out of control. She was 44 years old, and at 5'5", weighed 237 pounds. She worried about following in the path of her father, who for years did not control his diabetes.
And he has had a few amputations. He's blind. And that definitely scared me straight.
At first, Dexter L. says her doctor was wary of the fasting approach. But he saw her weight and bad cholesterol dip.
My numbers just improved in every area. So he eventually kind of came around to it.
So are a number of other doctors and scientists.
Our ancestors, before the agricultural revolution, undoubtedly had to go extended time periods without food.
This is Dr. Mark Mattson. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins and also heads the neuroscience lab at the National Institute on Aging. He says for most of human history, we needed to be able to fast. Those who couldn't function efficiently on an intermittent diet would die. Mattson is going beyond these evolutionary theories. He's studying the effects of intermittent fasting on the brain and the body.
What defines fasting is a switch in the source of energy in our bodies from glucose that's released from the liver to mobilization of fats from fat cells.
So instead of burning sugar for energy, you start burning fat. Sounds great if you're trying to lose weight, right? But Mattson thinks there are even more potential benefits.
In all our organ systems, essentially the heart, muscle, liver. One thing that happens with fasting is there's reduced inflammation.
And he says reduced inflammation in the body is a good thing. It means healthier cells. And he says those healthier cells in the brain could mean better cognition and possibly protect against diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. He's testing this out right now in a study of older adults. But let's slow down a minute.
It really is not something that I would encourage people to do.
Nutritionists like Stella Volpe at Drexel University is not on board. She worries fasting could be harmful.
It's not sort of teaching them good, healthy eating practices and behaviors to be somewhat consistent in their eating behaviors and their meals and snacks throughout the day.
Plus, Volpe says there haven't been any long-term studies on people. Most of the research is in animals. Still, for fans of intermittent fasting, they say it's working for them.
It is 2:11 p.m. Just got off a conference call a little bit ago.
Mimi Dexter L. would welcome more science to back up what she's doing. But she doesn't see any reason to stop, even when fasting has its moments, like in the middle of the afternoon.
Right now I'm feeling a little tired.
She hasn't eaten anything in 17 hours.
I'm still going to push through.
And before Dexter L. knows it, it's time to eat.
It is a little after 5, and I'm home, and it's time to break my fast, and I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to break it with. I'm looking in the refrigerator. There are many options.
She settles on some papaya. Then she heats up some leftover stew. Later on, she snacks on some popcorn and has a couple pieces of candy. And that's it.
It is 9:20 p.m. and it really wasn't too hard. So we start all over again tomorrow.
I'm Alana Gordon.
Alana comes to us from our partners at The Pulse, a health and science show at WHYY. The podcast is on iTunes. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.